Okay, it's the 16th of August. I'm talking this morning with Colonel Troby, who was the senior advisor to the 23rd Division. Okay, so when, first of all, just to give us a background, when were you given the assignment of senior advisor to the 23rd, and then go from there into your pre-attack?
I think I received the assignment on approximately 28 April, and I arrived in Khantoum about the 1st of May, on the 30th of April. At that time, the division was, division headquarters was in the old headquarters of the 22nd Division. At that time, was that the division commander felt very unsteady about running the division. He felt that the possibility that tanks would come down the road from Tancan was a very real possibility, and then he wasn't sure that his soldiers could resist this, resist the tanks and stay in fight. At the same time, in the city of Khantoum, the population was almost at a point of hysteria. They were terrified that Khantoum would fall, but there was no way they could leave because the road was blocked behind them with enemy units. I think it was 95 Bravo were in on the rock pile blocking the exit, and nobody dared. The province chief didn't dare allow people to try to walk through because there would be families of the RF involved, and the VC could capture large numbers of them, and if, among other things, besides the known, for a variety of reasons, they could be held in hostage and all that, and then the families of some of the RF people who were depending on, in addition, could be captured, and they could, all kinds of possibilities existed as to that this would be dangerous in holding the tactical situation. So the population was trapped in town, and it was in this environment that the division had to plan to do tactical defense.
G3 plan of defense one.
Okay, now the division, the major elements in the division at this time were one regiment of the division, the 53rd. they had an airborne brigade, two ranger groups, the 2nd and the 6th, and sector forces under control of the province chief. All of the commanders of these elements were full colonels, and the division commander, then Colonel Baugh, was also a colonel. And none of them had really worked together in any kind of cooperative sense in the past or a command sense. And it was extremely difficult for Colonel Baugh to get these people to respond to his orders. In fact, he couldn't get them to come to a meeting on time, or even they didn't even show up at occasion. So that one of the first problems in the pre-attack period was to begin planning for the defense, and we couldn't do this without some level of cooperation from all the key subordinate commanders. So that one of the first initial moves we made was to, I contacted Mr. Van, and Mr. Van was aware of this problem already, but I encouraged him, and he had already, I believe, already thought of it, but he had the Corps Deputy General, Vietnamese, accompanied by General Hill, come every day to Khantoum at 8 in the morning to preside over the staff meeting, make sure all these subordinate elements showed up and followed some kind of direction, because Colonel Baugh just didn't have the authority, enough authority and strength to do this. With these other full colonels who were considered, they had all different types of feelings about the competence of Colonel Baugh and the ability of the 23rd Division to nip the group into a successful defensive unit. Because they lacked this confidence. They hadn't worked together, and for many other reasons you don't understand, they just weren't very cooperative. And even though it was apparent to everyone that their lives were at stake, because there was no way we'd have to fight our way out if we didn't successfully defend Kantung. So that was the environment, and General Hill would come every day. I believe the airborne stayed about at least a week into May, the 7th, 8th, 9th, somewhere in there. They were withdrawn and put on a 1 or 2 day operation to attempt to help clear the rock pile, but they pulled out after being there about a week. They were in reserve the entire time in Division Reserve. We kept two ranger groups on the main avenue of approach, and we realized that we had to develop a plan which would be could be best titled a reinforced division in a perimeter defense of the city. And we'd have to develop a plan that would knit these units together and allow them to coordinate on a perimeter, put out an outpost line of resistance out in front, pick up the enemy, and but the units were, when I arrived, quite far out from the city. When I talk about a perimeter defense, that's a plan for when, as the units withdraw into the perimeter, they would know exactly where to go and so forth. There were some units that could begin digging, preparation of holes and foxholes and so forth on the perimeter, but there were some units that were pretty well out yet. And up on 10 to 15 clicks of Bodin, we still held an outpost up there. We had the 6th Ranger group was well out in front of the, I believe it was Bodin, and we still held 1 or 2 outposts up there, and we were trying to hold on to them as long as possible. We soon found that holding on to these outposts forced the enemy to mass to try to overrun the outpost, and we were beginning to get some effective use from B-52 strikes under those conditions. And in addition to not being able to control the subordinate elements in preparing for the defense around the city, Colonel Vaugh had a great deal of difficulty controlling the ranger group without offering delaying action to give us time to prepare the defense. And they occupied this outpost, and one day we just got word that we were out checking, and they had some of our tanks up there, and they were doing a pretty good job of the defense. And one day the ranger group just pulled out and started to walk back, and gave up the outpost without clearing it with Colonel Ball or anything. And deepened our fears for being able to control this mixture of units in the defense, because, commanders have to get the permission of the boss to do things, and this wasn't happening. And we felt we could get the ranger group back all right, but they'd come back in one piece and an effective unit, but the real concern was that we couldn't, the commander could not control his assets. And but we also realized that in preparing for the defense, the job we had to do was teach the division thoroughly defensive-type tactics, conventional defensive-type tactics, limiting points, how the units in the perimeter would work together, movement of the reserve force to encounter attacking any penetrations which occurred, preparation of the routes that the counterattack force would go, getting the reserve commanders to walk the routes ahead of time, plan how they would do it, and come up with various plans for various penetrations in the perimeter, as would be hypothesized as to where these penetrations would occur. And so we needed lots of time to build this defense, we were also quite well aware that the normal tactics used around Tan Can and other places would be to bring in a large number, the enemy would attempt to bring in a large number of weapons and ammunition, mortars, and so forth, and bring the artillery that they had captured down and have a good solid artillery preparation of the defensive area before they tried to attack. So at least we expected that as their method of operation. So our defensive planning was based on a relatively small perimeter so we could have a good defensive perimeter and with counterattack out to keep the enemy from becoming entrenched in the high ground that overlooked the city at some distance out. So we'd have to attack out periodically and bomb and attempt to hold that high ground as long as we could so that they didn't become fully entrenched in within mortar range of the city where they could bring in all kinds of heavy mortars and give us a thorough preparation before the infantry attack. So we were trying to look for as much delaying time as possible, and the real command then was being exercised by Corps coming up there every day. Mr. Van, General Zhu, and the Corps deputy, whose name I forgot.
Don, isn't it Sir Don or something? Bill Don?
No. Forget his name. But he was a pretty capable Major General who would listen to all the elements and attempt to enforce the vital orders that were coming out to develop the defense. At the same time, General Hill was doing a lot of flying with our air assets, coordinating the air activity, and particularly the search of the cavalry units to try to find where the enemy was. And to try to pick up some tanks and knock out some tanks so that we could convince the soldiers that the tanks could be knocked out and to try to reduce the attack force against us. So a great deal of air reconnaissance was going on by one troop of cavalry, which we had almost every day. And we would brief them on where the main avenues of approach and get them to go out and look by coming down close and just looking for the trails and for the, any enemy movement. And we did pick up a number of forces in different locations by this method. And we began to build a plan for the...
began to
get a feeling for the enemy plan. At the same time, the outpost at Poly Kling came under attack in about the first week in May. And the reason they were under attack was much like the outpost at Ben Hit. They were astride one of the enemy's main communications routes and logistical routes where they're trying to bring in enough ammunition to mount a good attack. And the enemy was moving down these roads at daylight. We could hit them there and so forth, but it impressed me early in the month of May that they were pushing hard to try to follow up their advantage from Tancan. And to them, pushing hard was kind of pull these supplies up rapidly if they're coming down the trail. And Poly Kling was on one of the main routes, and so they felt they had to attack that. And so they began attacking it. We caused them to mass, and we got lots of effective B-52 strikes against them. We encouraged Colonel Ba to move an artillery unit to Poly Krong, which was just on this side of the river, but they could support them. So, but with artillery, he moved them out the day before Poly Klang fell. He took them up there and began supporting, but that night, he got worried about them and their security, the artillery there, and they had an RF unit around them. And so he withdrew them that night. And the friendly force in Poly Kling had been under attack, and they had been there a long time. And I don't really know all the reasons why they decided to leave, but they decided to leave, and they just walked out. And some of them got out, some of them didn't. But Mr. Van and General Hill and Colonel Rhodes were all involved in getting the two Americans out, and I don't really know much about it, but the important thing was it indicated they were moving the supplies down this route and others as rapidly as they could. This is a very important element in the... They were alert to the fact that they had to attack Khartoum as soon as possible before they could develop a defense. So Mr. Mann hit on the idea, as well as Colonel Baugh, both of them thought of it about the same time, the thought that the best thing that could happen would be to bring in other organic units of the division, and the 45th was brought up from down here, and the operation they were on the road, and one of the ranger groups was swapped for it. We were, of course, interested in bringing in the 45th and not losing anything in exchange, but the ranger group was needed elsewhere. So the 6th ranger group left as the 45th came in. And then the airborne brigade left, and also the 2nd ranger group left, and I believe it was the 2nd ranger group was then exchanged for the 44th. The 44th, Mr. Van thought, was the best regiment in MR2, and was down on Route 19. And so he, about, this was about 3 days before the attack, he suggested to General Zhu that he bring the 44th up, and General Zhu agreed to this, but with the idea that he would take the last remaining other element, the 2nd Ranger Group, and move them out. And so the 44th came in, the 45th was in, and the 45th had 4 battalions. 44th had 4 battalions, so we got 2 regiments with 4 battalions, and that's how we came to lose the two ranger groups and the airborne brigade, because they had, it worked out to about an even swap. But we had the division in its organic, all its organic units there, and although I believe that the division's artillery was left in Bamatua, and they were using 22nd Division artillery that was left around Khartoum.
Are you surprised they gave you this much time, though, sir? We're thinking of 3 weeks, really,
right,
before the first attack is made. And to me, I'm looking at,
right,
the old adage, pursue and exploit your successes and that. And here you have such a tremendous success at Tancan,
right,
he just wipes them off the map. And he's got all this, to pursue. Then at that time, it seems to me like the optimum.
Yeah, but we did have a couple of these outposts, which he felt he had to knock off first. And they were, although they didn't hold on very long, it caused a lot of delay, and we were able to cause the enemy to mass and hit them with B-52 strikes, and
attack air,
and that was considerable delaying advantage there. But it is true they gave us an inordinate amount of time. But in order to attack, they feel that they've got to have some kind of weapon support, and I don't think they had the ability, they had to move all their artillery and mortar ammunition and weapons in on by hand, and they couldn't risk them by truck coming in very close. And so that was probably the reason that it took so long. But at any rate, 3 days before the attack, in this pre-planning period, it was obvious to Mr. Van and to all of us that we had to build the defense around the airfield to keep resupply going as long as possible. And what was happening is that the logistical, the ammunition resupply was quite effectively done by heli lift up in the hooks. And the hooks would drop the ammunition and pick up refugees and take them out, and particularly concentrated on the refugee, the families of the military, taking care of them, not to, and the Montagnard,
families whose people, whose husbands were in the RF and the PF, mainly because we wanted to make sure that these people didn't quit on us in the attack. Yeah. If their families were taken care of, we thought it would be better. The logistical situation was built up extremely well with a fair, good-sized amount of 155 ammunition and 105 ammunition in the bunkers and by the artillery position. We considered encouraging the division artillery commander to plan the movement of artillery forces so that the enemy wouldn't know where they were, and other planning things were techniques were used in move that developed a good division CP, which they didn't have. And Colonel Bao had developed some misconcepts about that based on the way it operated in Tancan, and since Colonel Dodd up there had been caught in this CP, Colonel Bao felt that he could have a movable CP in the city and move it around under artillery attack and keep the enemy mystified as to where his CP would be. And this looked like sheer folly to all of us. And we finally talked him into getting into make a good selection of a CP and a good bunker and get up his antennas so that he could communicate. And because once the artillery began to really land in the city, that nobody would be moving anyplace. Or mines on the roads and wire in the streets and so forth. So we got him to establish a CP. We began to teach him how to organize a conventional type perimeter defense, and all the time we were trying to delay the enemy movement down on us. And at this time, the Vietnamese had pretty good intelligence, not only from the air, but by through classified documents, capturing classified documents. So, but we were developing intelligence as the enemy got closer. Our tactical air was delaying him more as he got closer because he was presenting better targets. And we began to swap off these units for the organic units that would follow orders effectively. And the 44th, being the best, potentially the best regiment, was put on the main avenue of approach. With the 53rd covering the secondary avenue, the 45th was put in reserve centrally, and the 44th and the 53rd covered the northern half of the perimeter, and sector forces would cover the southern half. We considered several ways of using sector forces, like attaching them to Arvin, but we thought it was better to keep them as an entity under control of the province chief, and give them the easiest sector, but a very long sector, the whole southern half, and to protect. And so that was the plan. And about 3 days before, about the 11th or 12th, General Hill was flying with the air cavalry people, and they picked up some tank trails and found a tank. Were able to blow up enough of the foliage with the helicopter blades and so forth, getting down and looking. They found this tank, and we asked the total missile people to come on up and attack it, which they did, and knocked this tank out. And this was about 2 or 3 days before the 14th. And that was very significant because they kept working this area over, and it was just slightly north of Bodin in a big, heavily wooded area. And on the 13th, General Hill came in to the CP and told me that in this area, he was convinced was the main division assembly area of the 320th. And he had come to this conclusion because there were lots of trails leading into it. They had knocked out two tanks by this time, I believe, in that area with the tow. And he was convinced that was the main assembly area. Then later in the afternoon, we captured a prisoner who said that
the division had closed into its assembly area or into its assembly area and across the river. That, to me, meant that the division was in this assembly area entirely, that General Hill had predicted was their area. At least they were in some assembly area on this side, ready to begin to mount an attack. So we still thought the attack was quite a bit away because we had no artillery preparation and the forces were pretty well out, but we had withdrawn and we had begun an active defense at this time, a preparation of the defense. None of the holes, for example, the soldiers hadn't dug them deep enough to get any real protection from the tanks, so we encouraged Colonel Baugh to tour the entire, which he had been doing, to all the defensive positions to get the holes deeper, to talk to the soldiers about how to defend against tanks, to practice using their M-72 laws, and we even pulled a few old dead tanks up and let them shoot at them, and got lots of training going on that. But the main thing was to get commanders to coordinate at the limiting points, get the defensive camouflage on, the holes dug deeply, and for the reserve to practice their counterattack and plans and so forth. And at this time, we did a lot of artillery planning of fires around the perimeter. We were blessed with having one of the best artillerymen, the division artillery that I've run into around here. And he was very capable of massing the division fires, and we even put on a few practice shoots for the troops to let them call in fires right around the defensive position to show them that they could do it, and with the sector forces in particular, to show them we were going to support them as much as the army, and give them some confidence in using the artillery. At the same time, we began to encourage Colonel Baugh to make offensive attack out to try to find the enemy, and which he did. And they were reasonably aggressive, and we made some very good limited offensive moves out, and we began to isolate where the enemy main force was. And on the 13th, when General Hill told me he felt this was the assembly area, that seemed most logical to me based on what we knew of the whole thing. We had a pretty good plan for the defense. We had the 44th in position. We had on the main avenue of tank approach and probably the infantry approach. We had lots of good weapons, anti-tank weapons on the main approach. We had the bridges, and we have a barrier plan in effect. The bridge was ready to be blown. The man designated to blow it on the word of the division commander. I didn't really think, though. I became a lot more confident when we found that the organic units would respond to Colonel Baugh, and he was doing his staff was doing effective planning at this time, and had lost the feeling of hysteria that had gripped everyone before. And now the planning was going very well. I wasn't too sure that the conduct of the defense would go well, even though the planning was, because they had never done anything much like this, this size before together, and so I skeptical about that. So it was about 7 o'clock at night, because we knew generally where they were, and we could bomb them. We were having a great deal of effectiveness with the B-52 strikes, and we could probably continue to knock out their tanks one by one as we found them with the tow and other tactical air. So I could see some reason for them continuing to press on and not staying out. And yet they didn't have enough ammunition, and we were quite certain of this, to really begin a large-scale artillery and mortar attack on our defensive positions, as they had done when they had more time up at Tancan, you see. So either they were going to have to depart from their normal method of operation, or they were going to have to attack without all this artillery preparation, because they hadn't yet been able to bring up enough ammunition forward to do this. So at about 8 o'clock that night, we had a battalion out on Outpost November, which was a little in front of the defensive perimeter, and one of the company commanders there reported, November was right astride QL-14, he reported he saw lights on
the road up ahead, a whole string of lights on the road. And this was taken by some, and by some of the people in the talk as some kind of a crazy report from somebody out there that must have been garbled, because who would be driving down the road at night? But I was talking to Colonel Bricker, was here at Lake Hoo, and I was talking to Captain Finch and one or two others in the talk, and all of a sudden I realized that if I were they, the enemy, and they weren't very good tankers, I might get on the road with my tanks and move down to the attack position that night. And because of it, they were being picked off one by one. So that these lights could be just the tanks getting on the road and coming down the road and moving into an attack position. I didn't think they would attack at night, but they would get in an attack position. It was about 8 o'clock at night. And I said to Captain Finch, I think they're going to attack tomorrow. This is all the evidence you need. It just comes together like that. Just at that minute, Colonel Ball walked in with a captured document, and which said that the enemy would probably attack at 0400 the next morning. And this was a document from an enemy division artillery to one of its artillery units, 0400 attack. I was absolutely sure in my own mind that they would attack when I heard that, because I'd come to the conclusion before we got the thing. And when I saw that, just confirming it, I was convinced they were going to attack. So I called up Mr. Van, who was extremely skeptical, and said that with a great deal of logic, they hadn't gone through the normal artillery preparation, and they hadn't been time to get set and really work us over, and that he didn't feel that there was any chance of an attack. And then I got several calls from the G3 and others who felt that we were very hasty in this estimate. Mr. Van said, calling back later at night and we'd discuss it again, because it's possible that this could be the situation, he felt. And my purpose in calling him was to ensure that we had air assets moving as early as possible in the morning, get them up there, because I was convinced the attack would start.
Well, did you think about it? Did you request a specter or anything to examine what was going on?
Yes. Yes, we did. I don't think we got it, for one reason or another. We tried to lay on the normal spooky inspector and so forth. And the air assets had been coming up about, you know, really being on station around 7 or about 8 o'clock. It took a while to get them up normally. In other words, at first light, they weren't up there. They were just usually starting at first light. So my thought was that we ought to make a maximum effort to have them around at first light. But that was very difficult to do, and Mr. Van wasn't really convinced that they were going to attack. Nothing more. We were able to do nothing more except warn the units to be prepared. And so at 4 in the morning, nothing happened. And 4:30 rolled around, nothing happened. And things had been so quiet previous to that that I began to think that maybe we were wrong. At 5, nothing happened, and I went back to bed. And at 5:30, the attack started. Now, unbeknownst to me, the Vietnamese had captured another document which delayed the attack a half hour. And they explained why, later the G2 explained why he felt that it was an hour and a half late. The half hour was a delay, and then there was an hour's difference between Hanoi and Saigon time. And so they were thinking on Hanoi terms, and that's why it came at 5:30. 5:30, they attacked in two columns, two estimated infantry battalions, we estimated, led by tanks, and we had no air available. The entire support was done by massing our division artillery, which was done very effectively, and the infantry soldiers and the artillery were what won that one. And there were several cases where
The tow has evidently got up there later and knocked out some of the tanks. But there were several, there were one or two cases which we later almost were able to prove that were knocked out by infantry in their M-72s, and one of the tanks was hit about three or four times by different teams who didn't realize that it was dead. And at least they went through the motions of attacking it, which we weren't too sure they would do. So, at any rate, that attack was later estimated by all to be a probe to attempt to see how tough we were going to be and if maybe we'd break up the way Tancan did. But it was not a well-planned, organized... Well, it was organized, but it wasn't an attack in much real force. And it was therefore estimated as a probe against our perimeter. So that that day went on with a great deal of air activity, and the air assets moved in extremely well from then on. They moved much earlier, getting out to position in the attack in the morning. But then that night went by without... No, I guess it was the next night. The 44th was about 8 o'clock at night, was again penetrated and began calling for time fire on their own positions in this penetration. And it was about 10 o'clock at night. The 53rd was under a heavy attack, and there was a penetration in the 53rd, and the 53rd moved its regimental reserve into a blocking position to hold this attack. We had two scheduled B-52 strikes coming in well out from the perimeter, and about 10 o'clock at night, I began to try to think about how we could use these B-52 strikes, because to me, the situation was almost desperate. If any one of those penetrations gave way, the enemy would be in on us by midnight and would have all night to move around in the city, and we would never be able to get division units to attack out. I was worried that we couldn't get the division units to attack out after that if the enemy really broke into the city through either of these penetrations. So we began to... Vietnamese were very worried and frightened that the thing wouldn't hold, and the division commander was extremely worried over this. So we began to... But we had given up the possibility of using B-52 strikes in this close because they were so close to us, we didn't think we could do it with our own... without hitting our own forces, and we had to stick to the rules of the game. They're very strict on this. Rules of engagement. So we began to, two or three of us, just desperately try to work out how we could get the B-52 strikes in and do it within the rules of engagement legally. And we found that by just continuing to work on it, we found a way to do it. And with the final step that an hour before we would withdraw some of our forces, armed forces, quite a distance, and that would allow us to get the strike in legally within the limits. So I called Mr. Van, and he was very hesitant because it was such a chance of hitting our own forces. But I convinced him that we could do it within the legal limits of what the MACV rules were, as long as we withdrew the force in time. Well ahead of time, our own forces just pulled back a little, a significant amount. And I had to obtain Colonel Baugh's permission, his agreement that he would do this, and he was very anxious to go ahead and put in the B-52 strikes. So we arranged for these to be diverted and to hit at 3 and 4 in the morning directly behind the penetration, of the two penetrations, one behind each penetration. By this time it was midnight, and it appeared to me that the critical thing was to keep the enemy from attacking prior again and reinforce. They had these penetrations, and
for them to attack into them and reinforce them and maybe break out would be critical, so that we began to shoot artillery into the penetrations and keep the artillery coming down on these penetrations so that they would be hesitant to attack, because we were trying to delay till 3 o'clock in the morning when the first B-52 strike would come in. Because I felt we could hold at this point, because they hadn't given way, and they were holding. The friendly forces were holding. But I wanted to make sure that they continued to keep up a stubborn defense until we could really bring in the big stuff a little later. So we began increasing the artillery fires into these penetrations, and just to cause them to keep their heads down and not be so anxious to attack. And that seemed to work pretty well, and the two strikes came down on time, and I believe they were enormously effective, because I think we caught the enemy without many foxholes or up so close to us. They didn't have much protection, and they came in right behind them, and both the regimental advisors said that the next day that was a very effective strike, two very effective strikes. And the next couple of days, we had tremendous air assets, because we had, knew where the forces were and the enemy was, and we could bring a great deal to bear, and we did, through all kinds of TAC air, artillery, and so forth. But the TAC air and the B-52s were, of course, the most effective, along with the air cavalry searching out sources. And then we began to strongly fear they would discover a weakness in our sector forces in the south, because in a conventional situation, they hadn't gone through that sort of thing very much, and they would leave to go into town to
be with their families at night,
because they had their families in town, and Arvin did not, you see. And so we knew that there were gaps occurring which we couldn't very well prevent. We just couldn't find them. Because some of the soldiers would leave at night and leave their positions and go be with their families, who we were very worried about, and there was still near hysteria in town. So that was a real problem, and the enemy got in pretty close around the airfield and began to shell the airfield, and planes were being knocked out on the airfield, and the airfield was eventually closed. Because these planes bringing in ammunition were exploding, or being hit once in a while, and ammunition strewn all over the airfield, and we couldn't use it. And so we knew that the priority task was to expand, push the perimeter back, to try to get more, prevent the fires occurring on the airfield. At the same time, we'd come so desperately close to having the perimeter broken that Colonel Baugh tightened it up, so that brought the air to make sure that it wasn't broken. At the same time, that allowed the enemy to bring more fires on the airfield, and so the airfield was closed. About that time, I left. And this was about the 28th of May, somewhere in there. So the airfield was closed. Soon after that, enemy slipped through the gaps in the RFPF position, and we still left at night. And that's how they got into the city and established themselves in the bunkers or in the
school.
Yeah. And so I think they just walked in. But by that, they had begun to... We had identified enemy forces to the south in significant numbers, but for some reason they never really mounted an attack against the south. They kept attacking against our strongest position, where we felt all along the main avenue of approach would be, but they kept attacking the same place, and we were really pretty well prepared to handle it there. And so that part worked out very well.
I think some of the
critical factors which made the difference was that General Bob did talk to all the soldiers and encourage them personally. Of course, the commanders were talking, but he talked to almost all of them on how to handle their weapons. We trained them on their anti-tank weapons, but his point was to raise their spirits
and convince them
that they could stay in that foxhole and be safe because they had dug them deeper. We forced them to dig. Jellabah had gone around and said, you dig your hole deeper. And it's went to individual places with his commanders and really worked them over because they hadn't dug the hole deeply enough. And once you're deep enough, and once it gives you a great deal of confidence when you finally get the thing pretty deep, you realize that maybe you can live through a tank attack, you know, and realize that it can be successfully resisted.
So that
the personal activity of Colonel Baugh, the drawing together of organic units, and the firepower of the TAC air
were the major variables, in my view, that
brought the thing together and made it successful. Besides the, and putting the 44th, the best regiment, in the critical avenue of approach, it was a well-trained unit, and they did awfully well. The soldiers in all the units did extremely well in this attack, in this defensive situation. Although I think everyone knew they had to be successful or they'd never get out. So those are the main reasons, I think, as to why it was successful. The leadership tightened up, and they began to understand the conventional tactics, which they didn't really understand, I don't believe, prior to this.
Do you think we erred then, sir, in not teaching them conventional tactics and teaching them counter-guerrilla tactics instead?
Well, no. Early in the MAG advisory effort, when it was a MAG, they had done conventional tactics, but the enemy shifted so much to the insurgency type thing that we had to put the full weight of our training on that, I suspect. And we perhaps could have foreseen a large conventional attack, but this wasn't foreseen by a lot of people, and I'm not sure we really erred on that. It didn't take long for these people to understand the differences and how to work together on this. The biggest problem there was that the division had very little experience working as a division, and they had been spread over one of the largest areas in all of Vietnam. So that was just working together teamwork began to develop as the commanders met every day and worked with each other and coordinated and all that.
Were you there then for the beginning of the attacks on the 24th, 25th in this area when they, it seemed like there's a slack period, 14th through about the 17th,
yeah.
And then we get a little slack area in there for about a week, and then about the 24th things intensified.
No, I think I left just before that. Instead of the 28th, it was probably the 23rd.
Well, were you there then for the realignment forces when the 44th was pulled back into reserve then and the 45th was put online in
that
place?
No.
Okay.
You say that was about the 24th, because I don't remember precisely the dates, but I know that I left just before that attack.
Just before the
24th. It was in a quiet period. Colonel Rotenberry had come in and spent two or three days with us, but he felt he knew everything that I could help him with while I left.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that you
can? No, I can't think of anything.